The Shortcode Podcast is a proud member of the MedEd Media Network. Inspiration, information, and guidance on your journey to medical school and beyond at mededmedia.com.
Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcode Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcode.com.
Welcome back to the Shortcode Podcast, a production of the University of Iowa, Harvard College of Medicine. I'm Dave Etler. We're here today with Levi Endelman.
Hey.
Arisa Mahaparn.
Newly graduated.
Has graduated.
Yeah,
this is her last show.
Oh my God. I love you all.
And CCOM alumnus Dr. John Pienta has carved out an hour to return to the microphone today just for kicks. Of course, there are no M1s here today.
Why not?
Because they finished their last exam of the first year and are out somewhere, no doubt, behaving responsibly.
Yes.
Yep.
I mean, that's just logic, right?
That's
there.
A given.
Yeah,
they would never be drinking more than 5 drinks per man and like 4 drinks per woman in 2-hour period, right?
Certainly not.
That's the definition of binge drinking.
You graduated, though.
Mm-hmm.
Arisa.
I'm Dr. Arisa Mahaparn now.
You went through the actual graduation ceremony. Yeah.
It was the surprise of everyone, myself included.
Did you enjoy graduation?
Yeah, actually, I really did. Originally, I didn't want to go because, like, as I told you before, I just want to, like, sit in my pajamas and, like, eat pizza with my cat.
Mm-hmm.
My cat in pajamas.
You were feeling the call of introversion, or?
Or the call of, like, sheer laziness.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I've never been much of a ceremonial person. It's like, I try to, every single graduation of my life, I've tried to skip out of, from, like, high school to college. I've tried, like, you don't really need to see me, right?
Yeah, but families don't let you do that sometimes.
Oh, no. My parents really wanted to see me, graduate. So,
yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay, well, you guys are flying all here from California to help me move.
You can't just sit on your couch.
I can do this one small favor for you.
You guys go.
Yeah, I'm like, can you guys go and you can watch my classmates and pretend I'm up there. Yeah, no, but I ended up going and I'm actually really glad that they forced me to go because like...
I was not able to attend this year. I had...
Why? I saw you there.
I was there to help set up, but I wasn't able to stay for the... For the ceremony, to my regret, I had stuff to do at home, but they always do. I feel like they always kind of do a pretty good job. They're not, it's not too pomp and there is some pomp and circumstance.
Yeah, like
but,
when you're walking in.
I mean, you got to do, there are certain traditions one has to adhere to. But then they usually have fun speakers, like Dan Rundy was your speaker.
Oh man, that would have been good.
Yeah. And
I see a hilarious story about Dr. Rundy the night before.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing is,
will he mind if you share this story?
Oh, no, that's not what I meant.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. No, he was with my parents the night before, not me.
Oh, okay.
Wait. Oh, God. Sorry. I just
realized. We're just kidding.
Never mind. Okay. So moving on. Okay. The night before, my parents were flying in. They were due to land here at 11, but the first plane that got, that was going from like Denver to Cedar Rapids got struck by lightning.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, thankfully no one was hurt. They landed fine, but like after a plane gets struck by lightning, you can't use it for a while.
No?
Yeah, and then they couldn't find another plane. So there were my parents at like 8 p.m. at the airport saying, like, we really need to get to a daughter's graduation.
Yeah.
And guess who was also on that flight that was canceled?
Oh, who?
Dr. Rundy!
Nice. Oh, he almost didn't make it.
Yeah, shoot. So he was saying, okay, if we rent a car now, we can drive overnight, make it there in 11 hours. Who's with me?
I had heard that, that was an issue, but I didn't realize why or that, you know, he was sharing that experience with your...
Yeah, with my parents and like Mark's wife.
Who, by the way... Lovely people. I met them. They seemed very nice.
They are lovely people.
Turn your microphone a little bit towards your, see how it's sort of aimed away from your face, the front of it.
Hello.
Now twist so that the front of the microphone is facing you.
Are you talking to me?
I'm going
to
fix this mine too, though, while we're at it.
See how it's sort of facing away from you right now? There you go.
Okay, like this?
That's perfect.
There you go.
Okay.
Hey.
You can hear me.
Well, good. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you graduated. I'm glad you're, where are you going again?
I'll be going to University of Kansas in Kansas City.
Awesome.
So if anyone's out there, please show me around. I get lost really easily.
And don't get sick.
Why not? Oh yeah. No, I just got my intern schedule. The first one I'm on will actually just be ambulatory stuff. So go ahead and get sick then. But later this year, guess what my first inpatient rotation will be?
ICU. Nephro.
Night float.
Ooh. Ooh.
What's that mean?
For our listeners
at home.
Yes. How do we explain it? Night float is basically like when the rest of the hospital goes home and leaves everything up to you, even the patients that you have never seen before.
Yeah. All right. So a good explanation, like a good example of that would be during the daytime, like all the teaching services, say, you know, your nephrology service and your hemoc service. And where I was doing residency, they also had the neurology service. Mm. So they at sign out time, you know, 7 o'clock, 6 o'clock every day would hand over all of their patients to the night float team for the night. And so the night float team just kind of, their job is to admit new patients and put out fires and spare people the misery of doing like Q3 call.
Hopefully maintain the status quo while everybody takes a nap.
Yes.
That's the goal. And like MRI doesn't talk to you. Radiology doesn't talk to you. Apparently no one talks to you. I hope that's not really true in real life, but that's the impression that I got. It's not true, right?
It's not really true. I mean, there's going to be a bunch of kinds of tests and stuff that you won't do, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Aline has joined us, I should say.
Hi, I'm so sorry I was late.
Why were you late, Aline?
I was having a very stimulating scientific conversation.
I knew it.
Could not be cut short.
I knew it.
Yeah, stuff.
It's Houtman's fault, isn't it?
It's always Houtman. He's just such a great boss. We can talk for literally time gets away from us. But sorry, you were going to say something, Risa.
No, I was thinking, I thought you were just like moving worms off the road or something like that. Because that's what I was doing. I was nearly late.
You were moving worms?
Yeah, it rained.
It's very kind of you. Well,
That's very sweet. Yeah. Otherwise, they dry up and they die.
It's all part of the cycle of life.
That's like the bird's equivalent of beef jerky, though.
You know? They're all.
Oh yeah. Oh, I don't roll the dead ones. Only the live ones.
Oh dear. Hey, before we continue on too much, we get a lot of questions on the show, and we love them. There is another new way at the Carver College of Medicine to ask your questions while you're considering your med school path. Our new virtual visits program. On June 13th at noon Central Time, I will be hosting a live chat with students from the Carver College of Medicine and our experts on financial aid, the admissions process, student life, and more, some of whom will be familiar voices. To join, go to theshortcoat.com/visit and RSVP there. We're excited to connect with you and discuss whatever questions you raise, or you can also just listen and lurk. Again, that's theshortcoat.com/visit. Well.
I want to come too.
Well, that will be weird. You have all the answers. Speaking of questions, we're clearing the listener question backlog today. So let's start with a question from Kaylin. Here we go.
My name is Kaylin and I am going to be starting grad school in the fall to pursue my MPH in chronic disease epidemiology. As an undergrad, I was originally on the pre-med track in undergrad, but the sciences were hard to succeed in and I had to withdraw, which crushed my dream. Now I have the opportunity to pursue my MPH and possibly get more involved in the public health / medical field in a different way, which I'm excited about. I'm not sure if I want to pursue my PhD in epidemiology or an MSTP program after getting my MPH, which is where I am conflicted. I'm 24 and will finish my master's at 26. I have a GI autoimmune disease and am on biologic medication, which is really, really expensive. So I'm also worried about taking time off after my master's to study for a year, should that be necessary, in fear of not having insurance coverage. Without having any of the science background besides a chem lab completed and some calculus courses, do you think it's feasible to get into medical school with my age and academic timeline nonetheless? I would need to prepare for the MCAT in order to apply and I'm worried about not having the time to do so while in school if I need to take lots of prerequisites. Thank you so much for the advice and help. I had no idea MSTP programs even existed before listening to your podcast. This podcast is truly making a difference.
Well, good. I'm glad we helped you learn something new about medical education and the paths. There are many paths. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about your path, Kaylin. First thing we should get off the table, you're not going to be able to skip those prerequisites. It sounds like you were hoping to, you know, not deal with those, but unfortunately, I would say medical schools in general sort of want you to have some proven track record in the sciences.
Yeah,
there may be exceptions.
It wasn't entirely clear to me whether it was an issue of not having done all the prerequisites or that there was a concern that they were going to have to take more. So I think the first thing is to clarify.
Well, she said during her question that she's taken chemistry and she took some calculus courses.
But she had to stop
because she was not especially successful in getting good grades in there.
But it sounds like she passed the chem lab or whatever. And so I think, you know, as long as you can get the prerequisites done or check that there, because it's not a whole lot. I mean, I guess you got organic chemistry beyond that. And maybe now, biochemistry
isn't required here anyway, I think.
Yeah. I think it's right. A new thing all around, right?
It's a new requirement for the new MCAT as of like 2016.
There's going to come a point where, like, to be competitive for med school, you'll have had to gone.
You already have
gone to med school. Yeah. Well, I'm perfectly qualified for med school because I did everything else.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is that you don't have to take those classes concurrently like you were probably doing as a pre-med. You can sort of go through them at your own pace. I mean, that does mean that your timeline is probably going to be longer than you've been thinking about. But get used to it, because the pre-med journey or the medicine journey is, as we always say, a marathon. Slow and steady can win that race just as well as like powering through it as a pre-med.
It's a marathon that you sprint and the bike is on fire.
There are such things, though, I don't know if you've investigated as like dedicated pre-med post-baccalaureate programs that are geared toward getting you exactly those prerequisites and then, MCAT preparation courses to prepare for the MCAT and then getting into medical school. Mm-hmm. So that is another option where they have dedicated programs that sort of encapsulate all of those prerequisite courses.
And and to that end, I think it's exceptionally worth looking into how that might be dovetailed into the MPH coursework or things like that, because, you know, there may be some potential overlap or potential for, you know, arranging it this very, you know, very dependent on your College of Public Health's take on the coursework and timing and things like that. But you may be able to squeeze in one or two classes a semester and catch up.
That's
and
exactly.
Still be a student the whole time. And
perhaps even still. I was sort of leaning away from post-bac because of her need to, stay employed. I don't think it's impossible to be employed while you do a post-bac, but if you really struggled with those sort of basic science type classes, my thought was maybe, you know, you might want to sort of concentrate on one class at a time or a limited number of classes at a time to get those accomplished so that you can have a really competitive application. That being said, you know, you're gonna have to weigh these options as to, you know, what's going to give you the most success, the most bang for your buck, the most, appropriate path that will work for you. But there are multiple paths.
Yeah, because the way she just described herself as someone who's clearly very, who has a personal stake in the game, who clearly is very dedicated to public health and accessibility. And I think that those are really excellent things for an MPH candidate. And that really might be something that you can really make a huge difference for other people in.
MPH is so interesting because, you know,
so
like
much.
you can accomplish a lot. Medicine, unless you're doing research, you can accomplish accomplish only so much at one moment. You know, you're with one patient at a time, basically. You know, that's a little bit of an oversimplification, but
no, but it's like my patient pool will be limited, but you go into public health, your patient pool is the state of Iowa.
Right. What do you guys? So, any other advice for Kaylin?
Yeah, I think the more that we've talked, the more that it's gotten to that sort of 30,000 foot altitude kind of view. And I think, you know, it's important to consider that there may be, you know, characteristic reasons based on your personal history and personality that made those basic science classes difficult and how they fit in your life now. You know, there are incredible ways that you can contribute to medicine and the medical field that are, you know, sort of not just the stereotypical, you know, doctor patient relationship and ways that you can affect, you know, potentially greater change, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, you always got to ask yourself, well, how does this fit into my life? And how do I move forward from here with this? But ask yourself why it is that you ended up in public health. I mean, maybe there are paths down the road the doors that will open down the road, you know, during your schooling for that will allow you to use your talents in an even greater way. Mm-hmm. But just maybe doesn't look like what the dream you imagined it would look like.
Mm-hmm. Yep. One other bit of advice I have, go check out Ryan Gray's podcast over at mededmedia.com. Mm-hmm. He sort of specializes in advising folks like you and your unique circumstances. He's got some great podcasts, and he also can sort of advise you in a more formal way, i.e. That's what he does for his living. So yeah. Give him a, you know, check him out if you haven't already. I think he'll probably have some insights for you.
All right. Shilling number one achieved.
Ryan's a buddy. I'm happy to throw him some, and plus he's,
throw the man a hamburger.
He helps us out too. So
it's not a bad idea to send some foot traffic his way for sure.
Well, also, I mean, he's probably sending me foot traffic, but, you know, I mean, the other thing is you get it, you know, in a situation like Kaylin, she's got to really cast her net wide for, mm-hmm. you know, as much information as much as, you know, so that she can integrate it all. And she's going to get some contradictory information. She's mm-hmm. going to get some advice from people that doesn't match ours. Ryan's probably going to give her advice that doesn't match ours. All that stuff, you know, mm-hmm. you just got to integrate and choose a path and go for it.
But gosh, her path is really, really wide open.
Yeah, she's, I mean, mm-hmm.
that is sexy.
In a lot of ways, she's in good shape. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, you know, finding that path. I would almost say concentrate on your MPH. Don't worry about your path to medicine for now.
Yeah.
And see where that takes you.
Yeah. I think doing well in her MPH and getting good grades will be a huge boon for her in terms of showing that, like, she has the ability to thrive in an academic environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I just wanted to point out to you, she, are we assuming it's a she? I
had to look up the name Kaylin. It's Gaelic for girl.
Oh, okay, perfect.
Literally,
Ashley used to be a boy's name. So,
if we're wrong, we're very sorry.
Yes, yeah. But you know, in 2019, gender is fluid. So
gender's not real.
It's all good.
You're not real.
So they mm-hmm. mentioned having an interest in MSTPs. Mm-hmm. It sounds like she's going a couple different directions. And I think all of the advice here was good of like, maybe Kaylin, like focusing on what you're doing right now and, you know, creating a record of achievement, you know, in your current field. But, you know, MSTP is kind of a long-term thing. If that's what you decide to do in the future, just feel free to reach out. I don't know of any good resources, like overview resources for MSTPs. It's really just individual programs that you reach out to, but you'll definitely need research, and it can be epi research. There's nothing wrong with that. We have students in our program who are getting their PhDs in biostats and in epidemiology, so it can be done. But feel free to take your time and figure out what matters to you and reach back out to us.
Sounds good. So let us know how it goes. Let us know what you decide. You know, keep us posted. Love to hear from you again, Kaylin. We have several questions from an anonymous listener who I will call Melvin Piebags, just for no particular reason.
Is he related to Rich Uncle Pennybags?
No.
you know, I wanted to make that joke, but I was like, no, that's low hanging fruit. Who is Rich? Right there.
Pennybags.
That's the Monopoly guy.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I thought it was like the guy who adopted little orphan Annie. Oh, no, that's Uncle Warbucks.
Yeah, that's Daddy Warbucks. Daddy Warbucks.
Ooh. An expression that means something completely different today.
This is Melvin Piebags. Hello. Totally different. All right. So go ahead.
Did I tell you guys about when I brought my dad for the first time to an open mic?
No.
For stand up. So when I walked in, you know, my dad wears 3-piece suits everywhere, basically. And like, I was a little bit dressed up and like, it, you know, it's poor visibility at Yacht Club. And so, like afterwards, someone asked me, they were like, yeah, we didn't know if that was your dad or your daddy. Cause like he's young looking enough.
Why does your dad wear 3-piece suits everywhere? I mean, it's
he's
lovely.
Old fashioned.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's very, like, we were getting
does
ready to
smoke
go.
A pipe. I hope he smokes a pipe.
No, he does not smoke.
Actually, I hope I hope he doesn't smoke a pipe, but I hope he has a pipe that
carries
he clenches between his teeth.
Of course. Mm-hmm. No, unfortunately not. Okay. Yeah, he's like really old fashioned. And like, as we were getting ready to go, he was like, should I wear the vest and a tie, no tie, cufflinks? I was like, I don't think you realize where we're going. It's a seedy basement bar in a college town. Yeah.
Cufflinks is overkill, Dad. Go with the vest.
Whichever one says dive bar to you, that's the one I would go with.
Well, in fairness, it is called a yacht club. So maybe he thought it was like, you know.
Potentially.
He didn't put it together with the lack of oceans, but you know.
Yeah.
No actual yachts involved.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still don't exactly know what kind of audience Yacht Club is catering to. But now that it's the same owner as Studio 13, there's like a lot of like, like drag performances and like more, I don't know where I'm going with that.
Young urban progressiveness.
There we go. Yeah.
John, you did stand up.
That is correct.
Why don't you join Aline on her stand up adventures?
Yeah, I think we've got some real potential here.
Yeah.
How have we not talked about this? What? Tell me more.
Okay. So, well, this was part of my love of storytelling and love of attention. Hopefully, you know, positive attention. But
I don't know anything.
I'm
about
shocked.
That.
But, someone going to stand up because they want to have the spotlight on them. That's crazy.
But yeah, so, you know, and just kind of putting together stories about my life and then, you know, trying not to rant too much about it. And and then that kind of turned into
some
friends daring me to do it. And then I did it and I was like, oh, okay, this, you know, you can do this.
Where was this? And
so this one, while I was doing residency.
Mm-hmm.
Did some I think it's fun. I gotta get back into it. I kind of crawled out of my hole, so I'm getting back into the world.
You should
spending time with adult humans. Although I don't spend time with adult non-humans either, so
that's true.
Mostly just my children.
I'm glad you pointed out that distinction.
We were wondering.
There's no
most of my time with adult non-humans,
non-human primates.
Yeah, see
now.
See, there you go.
And earthworms now.
There we go.
Anyway,
cool.
Melvin Piebags, what do you got to say for us, Melvin?
How do y'all stay motivated in the face of failure? The only coping mechanism I've learned is a growth mindset and focusing on myself.
Failure is a part of medical school.
Mm-hmm. I'm very experienced in failure.
It's a part it's a part of learning.
For me, not... You're experienced in failure. I am also experienced in failure. Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah.
I'm very experienced with Aline's failure.
I'm very experienced in failure in academic, in my professional life, in my
John,
personal
you said
life.
You would never bring
I'm
that
good.
Up.
what advice, what do you do? Do you just keep plugging? I mean, is that...
So I think the growth mindset is awesome, to start with.
Let's unpack that a little bit. Yeah.
So I think that's an expression referring to looking at experiences for looking at the experience of a thing as opposed to like the outcome,
mm-hmm.
And treating it as like a black and white, like pass or fail.
Yeah.
And I think that's a great place to start. And I think, you know, what is failure? Is it a goal that you set out to achieve that's not achieved, but then, you know, there are other things you accomplished on the way there. Like, you didn't learn nothing. Maybe you just didn't accomplish the very thing you set out to do. But like, every experience leads to some type of growth or improvement. And I think focusing on that and not over amplifying the thing that didn't happen is a great way to, you know, not kill your motivation.
Spot on about like not concentrating on like what could have been instead of like what really did happen.
Yeah.
And also kind of adjusting one's own personal definition of what failure is and what success is. That was something coming into medical school. I had a very different idea of. And over the last 3 years, it has changed quite a bit. And then just making sure every time that, you know, you do, by your own definition, fail at something or you don't do as well, that you try to take from it what you can and you learn from it. I've found personally, I learn way more from things that I've done wrong than I ever have things that I have done right.
Yeah.
And so true. Everybody concentrates, I think, on outcomes, like the outcome of this thing. Is positive. Is success and that's the only thing that will, you know, that will do. But
and I think it's easy to pinpoint why, you know, we're so sort of results oriented, productivity oriented. Things that don't turn out the way that you planned can be hugely devastating.
A poor result.
Yeah. And I think that's been the, you know, that's been the story of my life for the last year, you know, just trying to figure out, you know, how to put those things together. And I think a big part of this, and my, you know, a standard analogy for this is like, you know, you get all your groceries or your stuff, you know, that you want to carry into the house, and you know, like, you don't want to make two trips, right, Dave? You know,
that's me.
You want to like do it. You want to carry it all in one go. So you kind of like just sort of pile it all on. And then you're like, oh, okay, all right, this is working, you know, and then you open the car door and something slips. So that's a failure, right? So then you adjust and you kind of move it, maybe you move it to a different position and you're like, all right, this is awesome. I got this. Then you get to the house door and you go, shh. You get to the house door and you're like, you're like, everything is balanced. It's perfect. And then you get to the door and you're like, wait a minute, I only have two hands. And
this example,
which one's going to open the door?
Right. So then you've got to then. So that's a failure. Right. So then you've got to iterate again and you've got to say, well, how am I going to like, I'm going to like stand like a crane on one leg and like balance some of this stuff on my knee. So now I can like open the door. Right. And so, I mean, I think that's kind of the way to think about it, is that we do that intuitively all the time. You're not even thinking about that when you do that. And you have to look at the sort of input output problem and say, hey, you know, I failed X, Y, or Z based on this narrative that I created about what should have happened or what should happen or what I'm really good at, et cetera. You got to kind of try to look a little more objectively at it and then kind of ask yourself like, okay, well, is there a systematic reason why this failed? Did I just get unlucky, you know, or whatever? And then you kind of do the process again. And, you know, I think everyone has said it here too, is like the, you know, you learn way more from failing, than you do from not failing. I mean, that's how you learn how to build the better model of yourself, the world, whatever it is you're studying, right? Like, you know, you just want to make sure, obviously, you know, make sure your failure's not like marked in blood, but.
I hope by the time I die, I have optimized the carrying of groceries from the car to the house in such a way as to, you know, not drop anything on my toe or, you know, achieve the closing of the Prius hatchback that is incredibly heavy for such a small car and causes me all kinds of concern. And that's my goal in life. I don't have strong goals. I don't have exciting goals. That's my goal.
But they are practical.
Very practical.
Well, learn to fail and fail well. Learn to fail and learn to fail with the minimum negative consequences. And maybe fail more, you know?
Who knows?
Maybe not on purpose, but like, you know,
failure's not it's looked at very negatively and, you know, sometimes it's hard to convince other people that your failure is a positive one. But you don't always need to do that. What you have to do is convince yourself that your failure, you know, if you want to call it that, means something. Means something and can help you.
if anything, medical school has made me, has like beaten into me being very good at like taking previously what I thought would be failures and just maintaining a big picture view, saying like, I didn't get a 270 on step one. Okay, but I still got XYZ. Or I did not get straight fives on my evals in a glowing evaluation. Okay, but I still passed.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, like, okay, I didn't graduate as a valedictorian top of my class and cure cancer. Okay, but I'm MD.
P equals MD, which is not to say that you should strive for a P, perhaps. But if you get a P, everything else above that is gravy.
Wait, what's a P?
Pass.
Oh, okay. I thought you.
I forgot to. I didn't explain. Pass equals MD. That's the sort of common saying for people who have just received a shitty grade.
I think we even have a session during orientation where Dean Cooper talks to the families of incoming medical students to be like, hey, so if your kid comes home with like a 75 on a test, that's a good grade. Don't give them crap for that. Like, they're not supposed to be getting 100%. Like, that's a very specific type, like a specific phenotype of student who gets 100% on med school tests. So.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not even a shitty grade. It's a passing grade. It's what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the common ways that people on this medical school path fail is to have to reapply to medical school. And that was one of the questions that I did not make a robot voice for Melvin Piebags. Did any of you reapply?
I was a reapplicant.
So how did you decide to spend the next year?
So I think it goes back to, you know, echoing the advice that I've said for all of these, is that a big part of this is you need to learn about yourself and learn about your strengths and weaknesses. And then also, you know, find ways to make those work for you and work for the people around you. I mean, I think, you know, it's all well and good that you know, we all want to do everything and be good at everything. But knowing yourself helps you pick things that it kind of reminds me of that 10,000 hours thing, right? So the 10,000 hours idea, like, it takes 10,000 hours to be sort of a master of anything. The very least, you want to walk away from this with 10,000 hours of yourself. Like, first of all, you want to master knowing who you are. But that's, anyway, make that ongoing. There are, I think at some level, there's overlap between some of these things. Like, some things, you know, time counts towards other things. And some people are more suited to those things, you know. So if you the thought of, you know, sitting in a conference room and talking to a big group of people or giving a lot of like public addresses and stuff, it gives you, you know, nerves, then maybe you shouldn't, you know, aim for that kind of a role, right? And I think, anyway, knowing what you're good at, knowing that is really critical. And I think that's what I spent the year doing, is realizing like, hey, I'm good at seeing this sort of bigger picture and putting all of these weird sort of threads together and building something out of it. So like, I put a team together to patent a medical device, and you know, worked as a paramedic at the time, and just kept, you know, I kept like knocking on doors and talking to people and saying like, oh, you know, I have this idea, like, what, you know, who do you think could help me do that? And just kind of doing more and more stuff like that. And then, you know, I reapplied. I went from like, you know, basically the not getting the time of day level quality of candidate to, you know, being an alternate in our program's MSTP, which, you know, was way, way, way more selective.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's what I would say, is like, learn about yourself and learn how you're going to apply that to what it is that you want. And if you, you know, maybe in that year off, you realize like, maybe I'm better suited at something else. That's a good result.
Yeah.
That's the best result.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Don't be so fixated on medical school that you can only see medical school. So.
Yeah. I think it's worth investigating whether or not there are like any glaring gaps in your application. just because it really is about balance. If there's like a major weakness, then, you know, that's something you should find out about and then address. But at the same time, you know, I think like John rightly pointed out, like keep living your life and doing things that interest you and stoke passion, because that's the, I mean, Amy Ahern says this all the time. Like what they're looking for is authenticity.
She's in our admissions office. If you don't know.
Just a real gem. Oh, John looks.
No, I mean, just what Aline and Anarisa are just saying reminded me of. So Chris Voss, the former hostage negotiator of like chief hostage negotiator for the FBI. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of really good TED Talks and stuff. Anyway, one of them, like his opening line is, you know, in negotiation, never be so sure of the deal that you want that you wouldn't be willing to take something better.
Mm.
And I think that is absolutely what this is about.
Interesting. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That is a really good one.
Yeah.
Well, we've got more questions from Melvin, but we're going to take a break to say support for the Short Coat Podcast charitable mission comes from the sale of T-shirts and our new digital download cookbook, Recipes for Med School Success, from listeners and co-hosts of the Short Coat Podcast, available at theshortcoat.com/store. If you want to know how to devil an ostrich egg, Arisa's got you covered.
Yep. And if you have any further questions about deviling ostrich eggs, you can contact me. I don't mind.
Let's be honest. How many people, Arisa, are going to devil an ostrich egg? Where did you get your ostrich egg, for God's sake?
From an ostrich.
Well, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so I was at the state fair and they were selling ostrich eggs, but only the empty decorative kind. I was like, boring. And I was like, hey, so do you have any like not empty ostrich eggs? And he says, yeah, but what are you going to do with it? And then I was like, oh, I'm gonna boil it. I'm gonna cook with it. And he's like, okay, I'll give it. Like normally they would sell it for $20. He said, I really want to see what you do with it. So I'll give it you for $10.
Nice. And you know, it's featured on the cover of the digital download Recipes for Med School Success.
One of my greatest art achievements ever.
I'm sure it's delicious.
The point of the ostrich
actually, I'm not sure it's delicious, but you know.
Dude, the point isn't that it's delicious or that you totally eat again or that it tastes good. The point is that you deviled a friggin' ostrich egg.
Okay. That makes total sense to me. I love it. Mm-hmm. Anywho, you can get that along with our spring 2019 t-shirts, which are selling out. So if you've been hesitating to spend $15 on our cool graphic tee, now's the moment to go to theshortcoat.com/store to get yours. Okay, so more questions.
Shill number two completed.
From Melvin Pye. From Melvin Pye. You're not supposed to say anything, John. Otherwise, they won't notice. But they'll be like, I have this urge to go to the Shortcoat Podcast /store.
But now we've like maybe made them laugh. Or even better, like made them roll their eyes at my smart aleck remark. And now it's like implanted.
But they'll be sympathetic to me, who's just trying to sell T-shirts for charity.
Buy a t-shirt to get back at John.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've incepted
on
them.
Dave's behalf.
That's a fantastic idea.
Yeah. Oh, God, I would do that.
You want to mess with John? Get a t-shirt.
Yeah, it's like putting John in the dunk tank.
Yes.
Which we did with several of our professors like a few weeks ago.
You did. That was interesting. Poor people sitting in a dunk tank in like freezing weather.
And the next day it was like 75 degrees.
Shivering their asses off.
Yeah.
Dave, you were one of them.
I was not. No.
Oh.
No, 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 no.
Well, let's Photoshop him in.
No, 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 no. More questions from Melvin. Let's listen to the next one.
Do you find it grim working in anatomy lab?
Is anatomy lab a grim place?
No. Well, very brightly lit. Full of chattering people. Oh,
that's not. I'm not. I don't think that's mood. What he meant.
Oh. What does he mean?
Just like the nature of the work, I think, is what he's getting at. Not necessarily.
Environment means a lot.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, if you're anatomy lab, okay. So do you remember the show Flatliner or the movie Flatliners?
Yeah.
Did you ever see this?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so their anatomy lab, inexplicably. Yeah. Was in a gothic basement, like a stone basement that I think Frankenstein had leased at some point.
Yeah. Very stylish.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And
props for the aesthetic.
And I've talked about this on the show before, that the professor was like, gave one of those speeches like, look to your left, look to your right. One of you won't be here next year, you know, kind of bullshit.
One of you will be on this table.
So, you know, that contributes. Environment contributes.
Different kind of gothic basement. Sorry,
yeah,
guys.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I had a friend rotating through PATH recently, and we had a really interesting and kind of thought-provoking conversation about having to do an autopsy on a baby. And it was really odd talking about like how acute all the organs were and how unbelievably tragic it was to be able to say that you've seen a baby's organs.
Yeah.
And so it is grim. I mean, you are dealing with death.
And you know, if babies don't do it for you, you might run into somebody who, I mean, you know, a body that reminds you of somebody you love anyway, yeah. You know, like this happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm laughing because of the choice of language.
I'm sorry. I was having a really hard time getting that out.
No, Dave, babies don't do it for me, actually.
In a sensitive way. Yeah. I failed. Failure.
And that said, in anatomy,
I've only got 170 or 278 of these episodes, which means approximately 278 hours. I don't have nearly 10,000 hours. You know, you're, under my belt.
You're never going to see a baby in an anatomy lab setting like that.
Yeah.
You know, so that's off the table. That's something you don't have to worry about. Not everybody has that kind of a harrowing experience.
Unless you want to, then you can go seek it out, definitely. But
right.
Oh, is this person talking about like anatomy, the course?
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was saying.
Yeah. And
yes.
And that's like these are people who've lived a long, full life, have intentionally donated their body to this experience. And mm-hmm. In almost some sense, like certain aspects are very reverential, even like,
they voluntarily elected to give us the gift of their bodies so that we could learn. Oh, God.
No,
you go. No, Irisa. Oh my God, just go.
Okay, reverential is definitely how I would describe my experience towards anatomy lab, because like you're in this room full of these wonderful old people who, as you said, lived wonderful full lives, and like this made a conscious decision that says, yes, I want to be a part of someone's medical education. I want to be part of training the next generation of doctors that are going to be helping my friends, my grandkids, and so on. And to me, that's like, it's like, I salute you. Thank you, sir, or madam.
Yeah, it's like many things, I imagine. You in life, you mm-hmm. your perspective going in, probably, you know, it's better to have a positive outlook on this than think, oh gosh, I'm going to be cutting up dead bodies. Yeah, you could think of it that way, and that's actually sort of what you're doing. But you got to frame it in the right way, really.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of about the mindset that you take the approach, you know, to anatomy lab. The first couple of times certainly are, it's different from anything you've ever done, likely.
Yeah. And some people might be freaked out.
Yeah.
You know, that's a just, you
that's
know,
fine. You're human.
That's a thing.
You're an empathetic human.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, one of the ways that I know some of my classmates chose to look at that as, you know, to get that in your mindset of, you know, going from, oh my gosh, you know, this was a living, breathing human being with family and loved ones and memories and this and that, to yes, but they willingly wanted to donate their body so that I could learn. So I'm going to make the most out of everything we do here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we even have a deeded body ceremony.
Yes.
Yeah, I was about to bring that up. I actually participated in my years.
Mm-hmm. How did you participate?
I sang the male part of the choir songs.
Oh,
we
that's
didn't
nice.
Have a male,
that's
and
nice.
And I have a really
though.
Deep voice.
Who cares?
Yeah. So
male is a gender construct.
Right.
Gender's not real.
Right.
That's right. You needed an alto or a baritone.
Yeah, we needed a tenor.
There we go.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And apparently, I'm a tenor. Yeah. So, but I found that was a really good way to kind of pay respects and kind of like look, like give them a big old salute, saying thank you for your service, sir or madam. You're we sometimes, to tell you the truth, when I was taking a test, I imagined like we saw their faces. So I just imagined like my lady like just looming over my shoulder, going, "Bring your ready, Alice."
And I think that whole thought process. Should put into perspective, you know, or can be put in the perspective of the fact that, you know, the goal of going into medicine for most people, you know, is the practice of medicine and taking care of people, right? And so you're going to be asked to have a degree, sort of a degree of responsibility that in a sense could be even more grim, which is, you know, real living people are going to then turn around and say, hey, you know, doc, I'm sick, or I'm in pain, or I'm dying, help me. And you're going to be part of that. And I think it's a good way to open up that thought process.
Mm-hmm. That's very well said.
I remember during anatomy lab, something that particularly stuck out to me, or something that actually kind of caught one of my colleagues off guard, was that there's this one of the bodies there had this absolutely beautiful purple nail polish, like perfectly manicured, gelled, like very, very detailed painted. That's just something that really stuck out to me. And that was like, wow, this was a person. She really liked the color purple, and she chose to be here today.
Interesting. Hmm. Okay. How do you, let's try this next question then.
How do you cope with a difficult patient or colleague?
That's a good question.
You tell us.
Because that's going to come up an awful lot in just about any, in any setting, right?
Yeah.
Patients frequently.
But the colleagues part, that's the part that sticks out to me about that question.
Oh, really?
Why is that?
Was we always hear about, how do you deal with difficult, we have so many classes on how do you deal with difficult patient, a patient who might be angry, violent, irrational, believe in conspiracy theories, stuff like that, that kind of thing. But we really don't have much training, or we've never really talked about what happens if it's not your patient, but it's your coworker, the person that you're seeing like for like 10-hour shifts a day.
Mm.
Yep.
Short answer, I don't know.
You don't?
Your answer depends on where you are on the totem pole. So if you have power over them, then you are entitled to gently criticize
push
them.
Push back a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, if you're below them, there's really not much you can do except, you know, grit your teeth and bear it until you get to move on, I guess.
Have really somebody hard. That you can confide in and you can at least talk to about it that's unrelated to the situation, preferably.
Yeah, the whole colleagues, that's not particular to medicine. I mean, anybody who goes into any career or who lives with humans.
It's office politics.
It's totally, I mean, you can't escape this other than aside from, you know, like walking away from a situation, which you sometimes cannot do.
Yeah. I think the difference in the clinic is that the necessity to resolve conflict quickly and efficiently is like disproportionately higher because like your job involves caring for people who are very sick. And so you need to figure that stuff out quick. And sometimes the solution is just to pretend everything's okay and move on. But
yeah, and there's some difficult situations too, where it's like at other jobs, you have things that are your job and your proper property that your responsibility, but you can't call a person your property. If you see someone else like mistreating their so-called property or something like that, you had the duty to call them out, especially if you're in a medical setting.
I agree with that. That is a problem I've noticed in the medical community. There's a real inability to stand up to wrongdoing, a real fear of calling out bad behavior.
Medicine is hierarchical, number one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people, you know, when you see somebody doing something and you're on the bottom of the totem pole, as you said, that you don't agree with, let me turn that around. When you see somebody doing something you don't agree with and you're at the bottom of the totem pole, it's very difficult to be that person who stands up and says, you know, this isn't right.
Even if you're not at the bottom of the totem pole, like I've seen this situation play out before, like from attending to attending, or like from peer, from resident to resident.
Confrontation is tough.
That's so
tricky. Confrontation is tough no matter what level you're at. And, you know, it's easier in some ways to ignore things and just be like, well, that sucked, but I'm not going to deal with it.
I can say I've had that. I won't say where or whom or where this came from, but I've had that.
That seems best.
feedback directly on rotations from people who have evaluated me that have, you know, just in at least orally have told me, you know, I see what you're doing, but it's not your place to say this or do this, no matter what you think is right. I have more experience than you. I know more than you. You think you know, but you don't. You need to offer your opinion only when asked.
That makes me cringe.
It's straight up said, you're here to learn and nothing else.
That happens.
But that's part of learning, is to be like, hey, why are we doing it like this? And if the person's answer to that question is like, because we've always done it this way, then you're asking the wrong person.
Although right. I would say that, you've got to walk a balance between, I don't agree with what you're doing, and so I'm going to speak up about it and possibly put my education at risk in some way. And okay, I've asked my question about the thing that I don't agree with. You have told me an answer that is completely unsatisfying or unsatisfactory. I'm going to file that way and use that as a way to remember that I'm not going to be that way. I'm not going to be that person. Because some people exist to teach you how not to be.
Oh, boy, this one hits real close to home. This is a perennial problem, right? So in medicine, you're going to hear a lot about this, lots and lots and lots about this. And you hear a lot about, error correction and error engineering. And they're going to talk about the Tenerife accident over and over and over. You're going to get you're going to get a lot of lectures on that.
A lot of trains.
Tenerife accident.
So this, what this was a, there was a basically two full jetliners of people, and the pilot of one of them who believed he had right of way on the runway, was the co-pilot or navigator. Somebody basically said, hold on, we haven't really gotten all clear yet to proceed down the runway. It was foggy, something like that. And they basically, the pilot's response was, oh, you think that, you're not here to think. And then I'm so-and-so pilot or whatever. And then throttles up and, kills both planes full of people, like 500 people.
Jesus. This is something that gets brought up in discussions with physicians, because
toxic authority is extreme. The sort of hubris, you reach a point where, hubris is not just like leading to a broken tchotchke. Hubris here leads to, can lead to really, really, really bad outcomes.
And this is what, I've given y'all this advice before for less important reasons, but you guys right now are cool. All right. You guys understand your limitations. You guys understand that you don't know everything. And that makes you less, it prevents you from being dangerous, right? At some point in the future, you are going to, after you get your 10,000 hours in or whatever, you're going to start believing. If you're not careful, you're going to start believing your own press releases. You're going to start believing how great you are. You're going to get some awards. You're going to get some, big deal, chair of blah, blah, blah in your institution, whatever. And the danger is that you can start believing that you are infallible. And maybe you don't believe that like out loud or even consciously, but I worry that, if you're praised enough, if you are as well, you should be praised when you are, brilliant and do things right and all that kind of stuff, but that you also lose humility. And that you also stop considering, maybe I'm not right about this. I don't get praised often enough to have this problem, so I'm lucky.
It's a plug to show Dave some love.
But
praise Dave.
Leave us a review and some stars on iTunes.
All hail Dave.
Shilling number three.
But anyway, okay, I'll climb off my high horse right now.
You're a reverse high horse. You're a low pony.
Yeah.
The only thing I want to add to this discussion is that I think in general, most people are fundamentally good.
Yeah.
And they're just doing what they think is right in service of patients in the clinical setting. for sure. But occasionally you come across someone who is actually very malicious and has slipped through crack after crack after crack and has gotten to a position of power where they have control over a lot of vulnerable people. And those people tend to exploit hesitation on the part of good people to stand up and say something. And I'm talking about people like Larry Nassar, or Harvey Weinstein, or Bill Cosby.
Like Dr. Death.
Yeah. You know, bad people. And there's, it would be naive to think that there aren't people like that in medicine. And there was one, you know, Larry Nassar. There's no way people didn't know what was happening. And it's not that they ignored it. It's a combination of, you know, not wanting to rock the boat, but also him being exceptionally gifted at manipulating people and exploiting, you know, hesitation or a belief deep down that like, this isn't really happening. Like that's where sociopaths live. You know, they find a crack in the wall and they shove their foot in there and they find a way to keep doing what they're doing. And in that case, it's really hard to say, you know, it's hard to be the person that's going to like sacrifice themselves to bring this person down. And I'm sure people did try, but they just, the system is set up to protect people like that. And I wish that was different.
It's a social thing. I mean, it's not necessarily medicine. I mean,
yeah. And I think part of this is, you know, like how do you know which one's the cart and which one's the horse, but like it's a little confusing because I think there's a lot of things that contribute to this. Like one, the thought that, well, bad people do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not a bad person. Therefore, things that I do are incapable of being bad like that. That is,
you know, wrong. It's incorrect.
That's categorically wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the worst events in history have proven that that line of thinking is extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good people do bad stuff all the time.
Right. And I think
they don't always do it on purpose.
So you have to try to have a bigger context in mind. And I think a big part of that too is, you know, it's like, well, we have this sort of attribution error that, you know, bad things are done by bad people. And therefore I'm not bad. So therefore what I do can't be evil like that. But then you also, you know, there's that same set of thinking goes in and kind of exploits our cognitive errors in a lot of places, right? Like, well, I can't, you know, I'm not going to do that when I'm in power. It's like, there's a reason why the sort of trope of intoxicating power exists, because it sort of intoxicates everyone. The question is, you know, when you're really intoxicated, what's left? And that I think is, you know, that's a huge open moral question of, you know, how do you truly be good? How do you have a procedure or something in your mind that allows you? Because a lot of this, you know, I think another big one is the sort of classic military statement, like never attribute to malice what can be attributed by just simple incompetence. And I think
that several times on the show,
you know, I think that it's not always that they're like that they're stupid or uneducated, but they may be incompetent in the context of that. You know, the way that they, right, the way that they approach this problem is extremely disrespectful to people who have a different ability level or a different, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And they're not like a bad person, but they just like have forgotten, you know, like Dunning-Kruger, like hypothesis, the idea that you're so good at something that you forgot how long you really have to suck at it to do it, you know, to do it well. And so you have no tolerance for people, you know, you vastly overestimate how good you are at something in that.
I guess the other thing to remember is we've only talked about a few different kinds of difficult people. People excel at ways of being difficult, at finding ways of being difficult. Not all of them are as cut and dried as, you know, making bad decisions or being evil or things like that. I mean, they could just be, you know, they could just have abrasive personalities or
they never get their notes done on time.
There's all kinds of ways people can be difficult. And, you know, everyone, every way and every person demands its own way of dealing with it. And sometimes the best way to deal with it is to just say, well, this person is not going to change.
Be skeptical of yourself more.
be skeptical of yourself.
Yeah. Be skeptical because your thoughts, you know, it's like,
oh yeah,
who walks into a political like Facebook conversation or something going, you know, I could really be wrong on this.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it's, yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, you may be the difficult person.
Oh, no, right? That's possible. But I do think that there's some good advice to be shared here. Yeah, like
well,
in terms of,
we'd better get to it.
I don't think I've actually given any.
No, like, we've just done a lot of talking about difficult. We've been done a lot of venting about the difficult people we're aware of.
Yeah. In my experience, the thing that has had the greatest amount of success, and it's still not like a fantastic success rate, but approaching someone from a place of your experience as opposed to a place of accusation mm-hmm. and assumption of their intentions, I think, you know, immediately puts people on the defensive. Mm-hmm. But if you frame it from a place of like, hey, I experienced this thing and I'm not really sure how I feel around it. Could we have a conversation to see if, you know, I can have a better understanding of the situation? Like focusing on solutions, understanding, as opposed to accusation or being combative, I think will make potentially at baseline very difficult person more amenable to having a discussion, I think.
And if that person is your boss, always remember that for better or for worse, that person has a decision to make or a job to do. They may not be expressing themselves well, but in the end, it's their ass.
Yeah.
And they're also, yeah, that's right. They're accountable to a different set of rules than you are.
Right. And so, you know, this was taught to me a while back by one of my mentors in a previous job. And, you know, he just came out and said it's my ass. And, I appreciated that because it both acknowledged that, you know, he had a decision to make. It might not be the right decision, but it was his job to do that. And, I was, you know, I felt lucky that he took the time to say, you know, I appreciate what you're saying, but I've got to make this decision. It's my ass. And that made me go, oh yeah, I don't have to win in this discussion. You know, because that's not my need here.
Yeah.
And I have to keep that in mind. Like, it's not my ass.
I mean,
well, also, I mean, you're
yeah,
not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but it's true. Some things, you know, you can give your input, but you don't have to fight for it maybe
and
all the time.
That's especially important when you're sort of in the lower position on the totem pole. I think in general, what Aline said, it's like really awesome advice. Like if you think about how instead of like assuming that you know what they have intended because of how it's made you feel, you can focus on how you feel about it and focus on factual statements and things like that in there. I also think that if you focus on, you try to find ways to focus on common interests.
Absolutely.
You know, then that allows you to maybe sort of sidestep the highest pressure points and try to address where the best, you know, course of action going forward is. And I think that, you know, there's some really good writing on this. The Harvard Negotiation Project's Getting to Yes book is really good. That's like the big punchline out of that book is, you know, don't focus on what your position is, because people just going to dig into their position more and more. But if you focus on what your common interests are, you're much more likely to agree to arrive at something that's actually, you know, allows you to move forward.
Yeah.
And that I think that's more generally applicable when, you know, difficult people, because, you know, difficult people can be can look like a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Yeah. What I took from Dave's story, and to echo what you were saying, John, I think the best thing you can do is find a way to get on the same team, like get either on that person's strategic radar or get them on yours. But like aligning yourself with that person of like, listen, we both want the same thing here. We want, you know, this project to get done, or we want this patient to be taken care of. How can we be a team about this? Mm-hmm. I think that's effective. And having the boss kind of remind someone, you know, subordinate to them that like, ultimately the responsibility is mine. It kind of reminds you that like, oh, okay, this, we don't have equal decision-making power, but if you know moving forward that you want the same thing, which is both of you to not be fired or to accomplish
a goal or to, you know, get people through med school or to get the patient well or whatever it is.
Yeah. Great advice.
That seems like a great place to end. Levi, Aline, Arisa, John, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great questions.
Yeah. And what kind of terrible person would I be if I didn't thank you listeners for making us a part of your week, for all your questions, and for your supportive t-shirt and cookbook orders. If you're new here and you like what you heard today, subscribe to our show on all the places. We love answering listener questions, so send your questions and comments to theshortcoats@gmail.com, or you can leave a message at 347-SHORT-CT. And right now, give us a review, some more stars, positive review on iTunes. That'll help us feel good. The show is made possible by a generous donation by Carver College of Medicine student government and ongoing support from the Writing and Humanities program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox. And our closing music is by Catmosphere. Talk to you in 1 week.